The topics and opinions expressed in the following show are solely those of the hosts and their guests and not those of W4CY Radio, its employees, or affiliates. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our web. No liability, explicit or implied, shall be extended to W4CY Radio, or its employees, or affiliates. Any questions or comments should be directed to those show hosts. Thank you for choosing W4CY Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Connected Table Live. We're your hosts, Melanie Young and David Ransom, your insatiably curious culinary couple. Each week, we bring you the dynamic people who work front and center and behind the scenes in food, wine, spirits, and hospitality. We lead a delicious life, and we want to live it with you. This week is probably the Super Bowl of wine events and food events here in New York City, three or four a day. And we are honored to be attending many of them. Before we go into our show, we just want to give a shout out to one of our favorite people in the wine business, Kevin Sraley, who last Monday gave his final exam at the Windows of the World Wine School, the New York Marriott Marquis. Kevin's was a 40-year run on Broadway at the New York Marriott Marquis, and he is moving on to another stage, and we want to wish him well. It was a wonderful way to send him off with some Paul Roger champagne and a lot of family, friends, and colleagues. Right, David?
Yeah, it was really wonderful. I mean, Kevin, we've known Kevin for so long. He's been on our show a couple of times. And when he announced that he was retiring
not retiring himself,
but retiring the wine course, in the New York Times, I'm sure a collective gasp went up around the country that he was leaving the wine business. Well, he's not, but he gave his final class after 40 years on Monday night to probably the biggest audience he's ever had in the history of his 40 years of teaching. There were, I'd say, easily 200 people in the room. A lot of them were family and friends and colleagues that he had gathered along the way in his great run, who came there to celebrate with him and celebrate the achievement. It was really so much fun. Paul Roger champagne was poured freely, shall we say. And we just had a great time and a lot of back slapping and all kinds of good things that went on. So it was really nice to see Kevin and really kind of toast his accomplishment that way.
And for that, we're happy to have another Wednesday wine segment. Kevin really helped make us think about wines from all around the world. And today's show is kind of interesting. It's really modern wines from ancient lands, or ancient wines from modern times. Right, David?
Well, yeah, we're actually, I've always had a fascination with what I like to call emerging regions of wine, wines that, aren't part of the, say, big five or six wine producing regions of the world or countries of the world, and ones that may use indigenous varietals that we may not have heard of very often, things like that. And we've got two of those emerging regions, although they're not emerging, they're some of the oldest winemaking regions in the world, talking to us about the wines that they make today. The first is a wonderful winery from Lebanon, Domaine de Tourelle. And Lebanon's got a very long history of making wine and some fabulous wineries. A great legacy of wine has been created in Lebanon in the Bekaa Valley. And we have Fayouzi Issa from Domaine de Tourelle joining us today. And then the second segment, we're going to be talking about the wines from the Republic, not the state of Georgia. Another wonderful winemaking region, and apparently a lot of people say it's actually the cradle of winemaking civilization in the world. So it's got an incredible history. 8,000 years of winemaking have gone on back in Georgia. And we're very happy to have somebody joining us today to talk about the wonderful wines and indigenous varietals that come out of Georgia. Mm-hmm. So, but first, let's welcome Fayouzi to the show. How are you?
How are you, David? How are you, Melanie?
Thank you so much for joining us. We got to taste your wines yesterday, and it was really an eye-opener. There's a lot of people have known that Lebanon has made wine for a long time, but there's only a couple of brands that people have known. And one of them probably being the most famous is Chateau Mussard. But you've actually got a longer history of making wine than Chateau Mussard at your winery in Lebanon. So tell us a little bit about Domaine de Tourelle and also how you got involved with making wine there.
Yeah, first, thank you for hosting. I mean, domain Detroit exists since 1868 in the Becca Valley, and it was founded by a French family from the Brown family from France, and we were both from the third generation in the 90s. And Domaine Tourelle used to be the first producer to sell wines in Lebanon. So wines exist in this region since long time, primarily for the monks, Jesuits, church. But Domaine Tourelle was the first to produce a bottle to be launched in the market in the 1868. So yes, I mean, we were 60 years before the foundation of Musard, which I really respect. And Domaine Tourelle is a natural producer of wines by all means.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of Domaine de Tourelle. It was originally owned by a Frenchman, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then your family took it over. So tell us about that.
So we have, our family, we have two families running the winery. My family and the other family is from the relatives of the wife of Brun, third generation. So the Brun family came on a project for a highway, to build the highway in the Becca Valley, so nothing related to the wine, in 1864. So they built a house, and they were working in the construction company, and then 4 years later, they sold the house, and they sold the house to a man called François Jean Brun, who's the founder of Domaine Tourelle, who started to produce wines, and he thought that the Becca Valley was one of the best terroir in the region, and that's how it started. I mean, it's a beautiful story. It has to, you have to come and see the living museum of the winery, still untouched since 1868 till now. And then in the 90s, we took over the winery because the last generation was without any offsprings, so no descendants. And then Domaine Tourelle was both my family and the other family, Aïs El Khoury, which now we run the winery. We are the youngest team running the oldest winery.
Fascinating.
With my sisters, yeah.
You say you make wine in the Becca Valley. You know, Melanie and I remember when we were talking to you yesterday, we all had a comment that people think of Lebanon as being a desert, and that you know, how can you make wine in the desert? And you said, and you were very quick to point out that there is no desert in Lebanon, and the Becca Valley, where the winemaking industry is centered, is a very, very fertile land. It's the breadbasket of Lebanon, and it's a very agricultural land. So tell us a little bit about Becca Valley and why it works so well for growing grapes and making wine.
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, Becca Valley, you can ski in Lebanon. We have 5 resorts of skiing, so I mean, Becca Valley is known for the agricultural. It gives around 70% of the agricultural products for Lebanon, the whole country. I mean, I love Becca Valley because it has the great terroir for wines. High altitude, 1,000 meter altitude on the plateau, mm-hmm. with sun abundance, great rainfall balance. So we don't irrigate. And diversity of soil. So, I mean, all the factors, if we add the people, the history, and I mean, what we do exactly to the terroir factors, we will have the niche place to produce wines. So, I mean, just an idea that during ripening season, because we're on 1,000 meter altitude, we have 25 degrees delta temperature between day and night. So, which is really impressive.
So it's really almost a perfect climate for growing grapes, because you've got great temperature.
Exactly.
You've got great, one of the things that grapes love is warm days and cold nights, and you've got obviously great temperature fluctuation in the Becca Valley, and you also have high elevation, which also helps create that temperature fluctuation and also helps with the moisture and whatnot. It's an arid climate. It's at 3,000 feet or 1,000 meters. Mm-hmm. It's also one of the higher areas in the world to grow grapes in elevation.
Exactly.
What would you liken it to outside of Lebanon? What other wine region do you think is most akin to the growing conditions in Lebanon for you?
Well, let's say Mendoza. Mendoza looks a little bit similar to Lebanese Becca Valley. I mean, we have a little bit more sun. Mm-hmm. But they have 800 to 1,500 meters altitude, growing altitude. So I can see Lebanon like Mendoza in terms of terroir.
Another great region for making wine. We've interviewed a number of Argentinian winemakers over the course of this show, and it's always been a lot of fun. That's based at 5,000 feet, so even higher than yours, than the Bekaa Valley. Tell us a little bit about the styles of wine you make and the grape varietals that you think work best in Bekaa Valley and in Lebanon.
Well, I'm lucky to work in a winery that has more than 146 years old, mm-hmm. and which means that we have around 146 fermentation cycles. So the yeast is everywhere. We have a fermentation factor that is strong, so no need to get yeast from the market. No need to be extra chemically oriented. So we are a natural winery, minimal intervention, concrete vats, and indigenous winemakers, because in Lebanon you have most of the winemakers are brought from France, from Italy, from Spain. So, I mean, I'm very proud to say that we have indigenous people working in the winery.
indigenous varietals and indigenous.
We are native variety of winemakers. So we produce wines from mainly Syrah, Cinsault, Carignan, and Cabernet, and Abbaye, Viognier, and Chardonnay for the white wines, a bit of Muscat, and yeah.
So you obviously have embraced the Rhone varietals, and you really think they work well. But you also do a lot of, you also grow a lot of Cabernet, and you do a lot of, say, Bordeaux Rhone style blends with Cabernet and Syrah as the components. Why do you think Syrah, which I would not think would be something that as a Rhone grape or a Rhone originating grape would work in your hot climate, but you seem to think that it does. What makes it work for you?
Well, the altitude. In one word, the altitude. If we have so much warm weather, but the altitude really plays a huge role in creating the a balance for the Syrah. So let's say the calcareous clay soil as well. Syrah loves gravelous and calcareous soil. So, I mean, these factors really, really enhance the good quality of Syrah plantation. I love Cinsault now. The trend is Cinsault in my winery in Domaine Tourelle. I'm very proud to say I'm the only one now really doing a challenging, daring wine using 100% Cinsault in concrete vats. And with indigenous grapes, it's really, really showing amazingly.
And you actually make 100% sense.
Varietal
wine, and it was really a wonderful wine for us. We tasted it through with you yesterday, and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, one of the things you said was really an advantage was that there's no rules. There's no strict rules in wine production in Lebanon. Is correct?
Yeah, I love this fact that we don't have any rules, and I think rules can inhibit really the passionate corner of every winemaker. So no rules, and you can do whatever you want. This is what we can do in Lebanon.
You know, it's interesting. I want to tell our listeners that you actually worked at Chateau Margaux and were trained in Bordeaux to make wine. So, and that's very restrictive, as we all know. The varietals that you can use there and the styles of wine that are made there because of those restrictions. So it must have been a huge breath of fresh air for you to come back to Lebanon and basically enter the wild west of winemaking where you can really do anything you want.
Exactly. Thank you. When I was working in Margaux, this is a bit, background discussion, but I mean, Margaux were, some of the passionate winemakers were really, really sick of the rules. I mean, and I know very well that they were loving to work in a non-rules appellation because they have so much potential and so much way to discover new ways of fermenting, of using yeast or not, or grapes or varieties. This was a frustration in Margaux and I'm happy to be in a free land country where we can do whatever we want.
Well, actually, you're credited, since you took over the family's winery, of really bringing it to modern times and adding your personal touch to the production of wines. What are some of the things that you have initiated?
Crazy fermentations. I mean, full of natural way, zero intervention, just playing the role of projecting the wines, the terroir, the grapes to the glass. And no, without any, following any rule, you know, I mean, most of the winemakers, they like to follow recipes. Some of the problems in Lebanon winemakers are following a little bit Bordeaux style of wines. However, in Domaine Tourelle, the way I like to produce wines is really naturally the way it should be done, as if the winemaker is not present. So, I mean, in a dusty way, let's say it.
Well, let's talk about dust. Because in the materials we were provided, it said, "You love dust." And somebody actually called you. I think it was Decanter Magazine. You were the king of dust.
Yeah.
The dusty winemaker.
The dusty winemaker.
Dusty winemaker. I love dust. That's so, that's so important. I love that.
Tell us about your fascination with dust.
If you come to the winery, you'll understand exactly that dust is the number one soldier to conserve the terroir and the identity of the wine. So dust, when we conserve the dust, it means we conserve the yeast that were built long time ago, a century ago. And dust is an anti-sound, anti-vibration, anti-smell, odor. So, I mean, dust can really conserve the ambiance or the environment of the winery. So we're against cleaning aggressively the winery. So we're more into the natural cleaning of the wines, of the walls and preserving the yeast in the dust colonies.
Well, let's talk about your philosophy in winemaking a little bit. You're organic. You really take care of your vineyards most of the time in an organic way. You're not biodynamic, which is a trend of sorts in winemaking these days, and especially in obviously vineyard work. But you do embrace the organic vinification of wines, and especially out in the vineyard as well, because I think you said that, you know, due to your climate, you really have a minimal ability or minimal need to do things like use chemicals and sprays and things like that, and that's not what we all want to have in our wine, as we all know this at this point in winemaking. We don't want that in our wines anyway, so you've really kind of embraced that concept, and you do a lot of organic work and whatnot. Give us a little bit about the philosophy that you have with that.
Yeah, I think we are organic. The Beka Valley is organic by nature. So we have a dry weather, so we don't have the conditions for pathogens. So we have a dry, very dry weather in 1,000 meter altitude with lots of sunshine. So that means we are in a clean and clear environment to produce and cultivate grapes. So we do treat in sulfur and copper. So we don't. Most of the people say, why don't you get a tag of organic? I say, we don't need that, because people have to know that Lebanon is in a dry region where pathogens are not there. And for the wines, I mean, you said biodynamics. I don't believe, although I had a great experience in my go in testing the biodynamics in Bordeaux, but I mean, I'm not a big believer of biodynamics. I'm a believer of organic. And I think everyone should really focus on how organic we should be in a healthy and easy, practical way.
Well, we agree with that. We'd like to see that in every aspect of food and drink these days. But you see, Lebanon is an ancient winemaking country, but there's only 46 wineries in the country, right?
Yeah, it's around 46. Yeah.
And are they all in the Beka area? Or are there other? Tell us a little bit more about the different areas.
Well, most of the wineries are in the Beka Valley.
Okay.
Let's say the Beka Valley terroir is the hub of the great quality grapes. Mm-hmm. And even Muzar, I mean, Muzar grapes are in the Beka Valley, although the winery is in the coastal area. So if you want to have great wines, create acidity, you needed to have it in the Bekaa Valley. So now there is 46 wineries. We produce around 9 million bottles. The country produces 9 million bottles, which is really three, four cooperative wineries in Italy or in France. So we're a niche producer country, and Domaine de Tourelle does 300,000 bottles of wines. Before 1920, there was only four wineries in Lebanon. And then in 2000, there was around 10 to 12 wineries. And from 2000 till 2016, there was triple number of new producers.
So it's obviously obviously a growing industry. Is there expansion of real estate that's helping drive the growth in industry? And is it a lot of local and Lebanese families and companies that are starting the wineries, or is there foreign investment coming in?
Yeah, mainly it's more about family businesses, small. That always start small, and then it takes more volume with the time. But the idea of why it's growing, because this is a bit personal opinion, because of the international crowd that is really looking towards Lebanon, that this is a country with beautiful history. And Phoenicians were in Lebanon. Phoenicians had lots of trade in wines. So we have a great story, and the export market and the foreign market is looking about Lebanon. Show me what you have wines, show me what you have a potential, and then this is enhancing people from Lebanon to say, yes, I'm gonna invest in wines because we have something really good to export.
Well, you do, and you make really good wines. You know, I can say that of the Lebanese wines I've had, they've all been really well made. They're all, including yours, and I've noticed that they have an incredible potential to age. Like, really, some of the best wines in the world have that potential, and I think the wines of Lebanon have that as well. Melanie and I have been fortunate enough to try. Harking back to Chateau Musard, Chateau Musard wines back into the 1960s, and I see that same potential with your wines.
Exactly, we have great potential of aging. I mean, I had the idea of my sense 100% went out because we have a 1976 100% sense to the winery. And 100% 1976 Senso was really showing excellent, so that's why we thought that the wines can really age, even the Senso can really age.
You know, in a little bit of time we have left. Sorry, Dave is moving around. In a little bit of time left, tell us about the wines. Tell us about the wines that we tasted with you yesterday. Your signature, your flagship wines, and then the other ones.
I mean, my flagship point now is the Senso 100% Fevin. I love it. It's cherry. It has a cherry taste. Lots of ripening fruits. Very direct, open wine. Very easy to drink. Round wine. Nowadays, the key is to produce young, easy to drink wines with a structure and fine tannins. I love this wine. It's made in concrete vats, aged a little bit in oak, neutral oak, just to round shade wine. Mm-hmm. Another wine is the Marquis de Bay that I love. I mean, I love the Marquis de Bay. It's a blend of Côte d'Iron and Bordeaux style. So it's Syrah 50% and Cabernet Sauvignon 50% aged in French oak barrels. Mm-hmm. This wine has really 20, 30 years old potential age.
Which, and I think it's a wonderful wine. I think it's also a very unique wine because, you know, a lot of people do majority of one or the other, whether it's Cabernet or Syrah, and then they may blend a little bit of something else into it. You're doing a 50-50 blend, which is also pretty unique in the wine world.
Exactly.
A wonderful wine. I think it's got great aging potential. It's got full body. It's got great tannins to it, and really a pleasant wine for me to try.
Thank you.
We were taken by all of them. I like the one that we just discussed, and the white. Your Domaine de Tourelle white is fabulous.
Yeah, the Domaine de Tourelle white is really, really an impressive wine. And let's say the quality versus price is really fantastic. It's a blend of Viognier, Chardonnay, Albaidi, which is a native variety, and little drops of Muscat. So this wine is in 1,100 meter altitude, gravelous soil, and the Viognier is really nervous, and Albaidi gives volume to the wine. I like this wine. I mean, for the price and the quality we do in Lebanon, knowing that Lebanese whites are becoming more trendy in the past 5 years. So before 2010, we were producing in Lebanon 95% red wines, and now the white wines are taking much more, much more sense and are showing great.
Well, this is a very appealing wine. I think it'll be appealing to the U.S. market.
Exactly.
How can people get in touch with Domaine du Tourelle wines, and can they find them in line? And what's your distribution, I would think, in the U.S.?
We distributed around 17 countries with distributors that have a little bit similar approach. In New York, we're handled by VOS Selections. And we love this firm because, I mean, they believe in us. They believe in the way we produce as family spirit, and we're going excellent for them.
Okay. Well, we want to thank you. We've been talking with Feyyou Saissa, Domaine du Tourelle, Lebanon.
Thank you, Manon.
And we'll see you at Lebanese Wine Day in 2 days.
Sure. Thank you, Manon. Cheers, David. See you soon.
Feyyou, it's very nice to talk to you. Thank you for joining us. And folks, you can find more information on Domaine du Tourelle and the wines of Lebanon on our website, on our blog post from this week, which you can find at theconnectedtable.com. We'll be right back, and we're going to talk about the wines from the Republic of Georgia on our return. Stay tuned.
We're your hosts, Melanie Young and David Ransom, your insatiably curious culinary couple. You can find all our shows on iHeart.com and the free iHeart app anytime, anywhere. So check out this segment and all. And of course, please join us at Connected Table on Twitter, The Connected Table on Instagram, and Facebook Connected Table. So today's theme has been modern wines from ancient lands, or ancient wines from modern times. And in the first segment, we spoke with Feyyou Saissa of Domaine du Tourelle from Lebanon. He is the youngest winemaker from the oldest commercial winery in Lebanon. Very cool. Well, this next segment, we're talking about wines from Georgia, not Georgia the state, but the Republic of Georgia, which is located just north of Turkey on the Baltic Sea. It used to be part of the Soviet Union. It's now an independent republic. And it is called, Georgia is considered the cradle of wine. Why? Because it has an 8,000-year history. in making wine. And get this, over 500 native varietals. We learned that recently at a dinner. Actually, it was called a supra, S-U-P-R-A, which is a traditional Georgian feast and celebration at the newly opened Rouge Tamat that our friends from Wines of Georgia hosted, where we met a delegation from Georgia and tasted grapes that were a total discovery to me. What about you, David?
Well, they were actually, I can't say that they were completely a discovery for me, because one of the main varietals, one of the main white varietals that they make there is a grape called Arcazzatelli. And that actually is also grown and has been grown for 60 years in New York State, of all places. And it was planted here by a pioneering winemaker who came from the region, from that region, called Dr. Konstantin Frank, who planted Arcazzatelli up in the Finger Lakes in the 1950s when he was doing tests on whether vinifera grapes would grow. And it's been here ever since. And now there's other wineries in New York that make that wine as well. So I've known Arcazzatelli for a long time, but that's probably the only one of the 550 varieties that they grow there that I did know. But then it's a fascinating country and yet again, an emerging region that's made wine for thousands of years that I just want to know more about.
So we have not been to Georgia. So we have, talking to our friends, we met our new friends from Georgia, we have invited on a sommelier who has been recently to Georgia and is going to impress upon it. Well, he's going to talk about his career as well, and he's going to impress upon us this discovery of Georgia, since the theme of today's show is ancient wines and modern wines from ancient civilizations. His name is Taylor Parsons. He is from Los Angeles. This is kind of interesting, David. He is he was named Los Angeles Louis' top sommelier. He was a Star Chef's Rising Star Sommelier for 2015, and the Food and Wine Magazine Best Sommelier. So numerous recognitions. This is kind of cool about Taylor. He's a jazz pianist, and I know since you're a piano player, David, you'll appreciate that.
I am. So we can talk about fugues and preludes today as well. So
yeah, or jazz, whatever you prefer.
We're going to talk about what wines jazz you up and tickle your palate, Taylor. So
sounds good.
So welcome, Taylor Parsons from Republic.
Yeah, I wanted to add that Taylor is actually the sommelier and wine director at Republic Restaurant in Los Angeles. So
right.
And it's a great place, and he does a great job. So we want to welcome Taylor to the show. So welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, David. Thank you, Melanie.
First of all, tell us a little bit about your story before we dive into other wines. Tell us a little bit about how you got into the wine business and your background.
I think like most people in the wine business, I came to it in a sort of circuitous manner, a little bit of serendipity, a little bit of right place, right time. And I actually was on track to be a musician, and then I was going to teach Africana studies in college, and then I ended up falling into a wine job and really just falling in love with the whole universe of wine. David, as you know, there's a lot of crossover in wine and music, and
there's a lot of musicians that make wine.
Mm. Oh, absolutely, and a lot of musician sommeliers, and I mean there's a big overlap. So it activates a lot of the same parts of my brain, at least, and I just really fell into it quickly. Started as a wine buyer in a couple little grocery stores in the Tahoe area. I had worked in restaurants as a bartender and waiter all through college. Mm-hmm. And then when I moved back to LA, I fell into a wine director gig at Campanile Restaurant, which is ironically enough in the same place that Rip is now.
Uh-huh.
David's
getting mugged. Hello, sorry about that. David, are you getting mugged?
No, I'm fine.
Okay, sorry about that.
I worked there for a few years, and then I moved to Spago for a little bit, then I took over the wine programs for the Moza restaurants in California.
Oh, we love that restaurant. We love
Nancy's. Oh, sure, that's a great spot. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, my wine background is primarily in European wines, particularly in France and Italy and a little bit of domestic wines. So Georgia was brand new to me, and I kind of fell into that trip with a good deal of serendipity as well. I was invited to go pretty last minute. I wasn't really able to do a lot of research, mm-hmm. Which I would normally do, and I ended up going with very fresh eyes and not a lot of preconceptions.
Well, we want to talk about that because we actually went to a dinner, the Supra, at Rouge Tamat, and Pascaline Lepeltier waxed poetic about Georgian wines. And I think somebody's phone is ringing. So she waxed poetic about them and talked about how they should be, more on more lists. What were your impressions, initially, since you do nothing, I mean, you know, more or less, you know it because you're a sommelier. What were your first impressions when you got there to Georgia?
Well, I mean, Georgia's in a pretty interesting part of the universe. You have Russia to the north, Turkey and Armenia and Azerbaijan kind of all on the southern border, Black Sea on the west side. It's not in an area that most people associate with winemaking unless you really start to look at the history of winemaking, and then you see that this sort of is the cradle of wine. Armenia has a claim, Azerbaijan has a claim, but you know, this part of the world is pretty definitively where winemaking originated, or at least has an extremely old example. My first impressions were trying to sort out how the more recent history of Georgia was interacting with the more ancient history of Georgian winemaking.
Are you talking about politically, the political aspect of it, or?
Well, yeah, but I mean, politics has a way of meandering into industry and also into agriculture. And I think, you know, as a Soviet republic, Georgia had a very different wine industry than it did historically speaking. So I think that's only being sorted out now. And I think now is a super interesting time to look into Georgia just because of everything that's happening there. It is ancient. Anciently, over the millennia, Georgia was, you know, an incredible cradle of home winemaking, small-scale winemaking.
It
still is, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, every talking to Georgians as much as possible about this, basically the topography of the story is that as invading cultures came through, which they did for centuries and millennia, they would typically rip out vines and people would kind of take the winemaking into the home. And over time, this kind of became entrenched. The thing that was most astonishing to me about Georgia is how omnipresent wine is. We think of cultures like Italy and France as being very wine-driven cultures where wine is sort of everywhere. I mean, Georgia makes France and Italy look like wine hobbyists. I mean, literally, wine is everywhere. People drink it in copious quantities. They make it in copious quantities. Everyone is involved somehow in wine and winemaking, at least of the people that I met. And you walk through the streets of Tbilisi, the capital, and there's wine bars everywhere. And it's really quite something. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, it's also, you know, I want to get back to you, but I also found that it was what we've learned so far is that it's fascinating to me how diverse the winemaking and wine culture is there. Mm-hmm. With, you know, as we touched on earlier, there's over 500 indigenous varietals that can be tapped to make wine there. Not all of them are, because that would just cloud everybody to not being able to focus on one wine from the other. And there's some obviously very well-known varietals that have come out of Georgia. But it's not a culture that's tiny in any way that has regulations like Bordeaux has, where you can grow four or five grape types and that's it. It's a massive wine and grape growing culture that everybody enjoys having a piece of and enjoys the ability to have that diversity with.
Right.
Absolutely. And I think that the other interesting piece is that it's a largely insular wine culture. You know, it's not, I personally, with very few exceptions, I didn't encounter a lot of people that were even drinking or talking about French wine, Italian wine. It was people in Georgia are very interested in preserving, maintaining, and progressing their own indigenous winemaking heritage. And as a result, the wines that you see and drink in Georgia are Georgian wines made with Georgian indigenous varieties.
Let's talk about some of those.
Sure, let's do it. I mean, you mentioned Riccatatelli, obviously, and the red equivalent is Saporavi. So those were the grapes that were, you know, have had a long historical connection with the place. They were also the grapes that were promoted by the Soviets. So those were the two grapes that really were in abundance for decades of Soviet rule. And they still are. They are, to my knowledge, the most widely planted. But they also
Melanie and I actually learned today that Saporavi is also grown up in the Finger Lakes in New York State.
Yeah, there's some plantings in California too.
Yeah, very interesting, and it makes a very nice wine. One of the things that was very interesting to us when we tasted the wines at the Supra that we were at a couple of weeks ago was the fact that Georgia's really embraced the movement of making natural wine. And we'd love for you to talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, you can't really talk about that, I think, without talking about the Quevri. which is the big kind of clay vessel that a lot of the small production Georgian wines are being made in. It's a large, I mean, for most of your listeners probably know, but it's a very large kind of urn-shaped clay vessel that's made by a small group of people. I can't remember the exact number, but it's under 20 producers of these vessels in the country. And they're buried in the ground. The wines are made in those quevri. Some producers experiment a little bit with stainless steel, and some producers with oak. But the primary winemaking vessel that we encountered was this quevri, similar to amphora in Italy, and you know the growers like Thierry Pouzelat and the Loire are experimenting with them, have experimented with them as well, and use them. So winemaking in quevri is typically done with some measure of skins and or stems into the juice. It's typically done with a lot of oxygen, so not like stainless steel where it's completely anaerobic. And the winemaking, especially at the smaller scale, is done with a minimal amount of additives. So wild yeasts, no enzymes or, you know, kind of stabilizations, no, very little filtering or fining, and very little sulfur, typically. Hmm. So that, you know, natural wine is a loaded term these days. I think it's a really important area of winemaking right now, and Georgia is doing it in a very refined way, partly because they've done it for a long time this way, and partly, I think, because working with quevri requires a level of hygiene and understanding of natural winemaking processes that is above and beyond what even conventional winemaking is. I expected to find wines with a lot of flaws, and frankly, I found very few. There was a little volatile acidity here and there, but honestly, the wines were, from the best producers, squeaky clean and delicious, just completely unique in every possible way.
And completely unexpected, I might add.
Absolutely. I mean, they're their own thing, for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. You know, we tasted, we probably tasted like 12 wines at the Rouge Tomate Supra, the Supra. And I think David's falling off a chair. And we have four.
The Supra is an amazing thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it really was. First of all, there's a lot of music. There's a lot of food. There's a lot of toasting. Mm-hmm. What was the official toast, Taylor? Do you remember the official toast?
The Tamada is the toastmaster.
Right. Right.
And that person is typically charged with the making of the speeches at these things.
Right.
And it's pretty amazing.
It was really great. So we have four wines in front of us. And I'm going to just, we're going white to red. Okay. The first one is the Gotsa, G-O-T-S-A. It's mm-hmm. the Chinuri, C-H-I-N-U-R-I.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
So Gotsa is a very interesting producer for a few reasons. His name is Rebecca, and he's a traditional Georgian producer, meaning that he works with amphora, or with quevri, excuse me. But he's also a very progressive one. He's interested in you know, he chills some of his quevri, and he's very playful and experimental in terms of the wines. So Chinuri is a grape that is actually one of my favorites. It's one of the first Georgian wines I ever tasted, and from another producer, Iago. And typically, Chinuri for me is a wine that is super clean, a lot of citric flavors, and typically a wine that that is a little herbaceous, which I love. It has great acidity, which makes it a very food-friendly wine. And this particular one that you're drinking has a little bit of skin contact, so you'll, not a little bit, a lot. It's, I think, 6 or 7 months. So you'll notice a darker color. Mm-hmm. You'll notice a little bit more tannin, a little bit more structure. And then just some of those dried fruit kind of flavors, you know, dried apricot, dried nectarine, things like that. And then maybe some nuttiness. These are common kind of common components of skin macerated white wines. Or orange wines, as they're popularly misknown.
I actually, when I first tasted these wines, the whites, I actually
you know, thought to myself, there's something almost like a Fino Sherry in these wines, mm-hmm. With the way they were presenting themselves, with the nuttiness that you just talked about. Mm-hmm. And then as I got deeper into them, I realized there was a lot more complexity than a Sherry would have. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're complex wines, and they have yeah. texture, you know, which yeah. is, I think, for a grape that has, Rocazzatelli is a little bit the same way, you know, high acid, floral, herbal, there's not a ton of complexity, I think, maybe on its own, but mm-hmm. the vinification and the vineyard management really adds extra layers of complexity of texture and flavor and aroma, and it also makes them very, very food friendly. It's a wine that you can really drink kind of throughout the Supa, and you have to. I think there's another piece of this puzzle, which is talking about how people eat and drink mm-hmm. together. I think, you know, you looking at French wines or Italian wines, you can kind of see the correlation of the Italian table, the culture of the table, and how those wines feel. And I think if you think about the Supra, which you experienced, which is a kind of a feast where just right. tons of plates of food all over the table and lots of different kinds of flavors. You might have, you know, lots of vegetables, but then there's cheese and there's the bread and there's meats with this fantastic plum sauce that they do. There's lots of different textures and flavors on a Georgian table, so I think wines that have this kind of, they're not just a one note. It's not like drinking, you know, a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc that's just kind of real narrow. It has a broad range of textures and flavors, and they develop really well in the glass. Georgian wines, especially natural wines, all do, but Georgian wines particularly, in my opinion at least, seem to really have a lot of evolution as you sit with them at the table.
Well, we noticed that just before we segue to the reds, first of all, the second white that we have is called Pheasant's Tears. It's a Rocacciatelli, and it lower alcohol, 12.25% alcohol, really lovely. And what we did notice, Taylor, is first of all, we got to give a shout out to Rouge Tomat. If anyone is coming to New York, it just reopened in a new location downtown. The food is fantastic. It was contemporary food, not Georgian food, which we can't wait to try with the Consul General. But the wines paired beautifully with every dish, which was fairly vegetarian-centric, but there was some chicken. Mm-hmm. So the pairings were incredible.
Yeah, it's a great food wine. Great, great, great food mm-hmm. wine.
And actually, the Pheasant's Tears Arcatitelli is actually bottled unfiltered as well.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So there's a touch of a cloudiness to it, which really mm-hmm. adds some depth to the wine.
Mm-hmm. Pheasant's Tears is a project of John Wardeman. Did you guys talk about that at all?
We did not.
No.
Okay. He's actually an American that's making wine in Georgia. It's one of the more it's a major winery in Georgia. And he's a major figure in Georgian wine. He's a super neat guy. And that Rocazzatelli is one of my favorites of his production.
And what's his name again, please?
John Wardeman.
John Wardeman. I don't think he was at a dinner. There was an American at our dinner who had married a Georgian. He was an importer. Very interesting man, but it wasn't him. My impression of the whites, like David, it felt like there was a touch of Fino. That they were deep, they were, you know, amber colored. For me, it was a newer experience. I really loved them. They grew on me as the wine progressed, and I kept gravitating back to the whites quite a bit. But I was very intrigued by the reds. We have two reds in front of us. The second one was the one I kept re-pouring. But let's start with the first one. It's called Lagavinari. How did I do that?
Lagavinari, yeah.
Tell us about this.
So Lagavinari is another very interesting winery. The proprietor is Ico Glanti. He is a former doctor turned winemaker. He has a illustrious history in Georgia. He's a super interesting guy to talk to. We spent two nights at his house basically just drinking. Until the wee hours, he was telling us stories about, you know, the independence and that period and making wine and all this stuff. So he actually makes wine from all over Georgia. There's a kind of a rough dividing line of east and west in terms of the wine regions. The eastern wines tend to be from a region, Kakheti, tend to be like the Pheasant's Tears, tend to be a little bit firmer, a little bit more structured, a little more intense. And whereas the Western wines tend to be a little more elegant and fresher. So this is a grape that is indigenous to the western side of Georgia. And it is tends to be a grape that it's Ochkanuri Sapere. My Georgian is not good, so excuse the pronunciation.
Well, you did better than we did.
But again, herbal, brambly, really lovely acidity, and some tannic crunch, some texture. He makes the wines, I think, with a lighter touch than most. I really enjoyed the finesse and delicacy of his wines. And I think they're, you know, this particular grape, Sabravi is a darker kind of, denser, richer, more brooding sort of wine. But the Ochkonoi Sapere is a little bit more finessed to me.
Well, we have a few seconds left. We have a few seconds left. So let's do talk about the Sapravi. The last wine here in our quadrants is Orgo, O-R-G-O.
One of the great producers that I encountered on my trip. All interestingly enough, they work with older vines, and they work with they're actually working a lot with a single vineyard of very old vines. This is also made in Quevery, but then sees a little stainless steel, lots of cherry, lots of darkness, woodsy, and a little touch bitter, which I love with food.
We loved it too. It was a personal favorite. And we want to, you know, Taylor, we've actually come to our visit together. We've come to the end. So we want to let people know that you can go to Wines Georgia at Facebook and Wines_Georgia on Twitter to learn more about Georgian wines. And for those who come out to Los Angeles, what's the website or the Twitter for Republique?
RepubliqueLA.com. Come
all
visit.
Right. Thank you so much.
Well, Taylor Parsons, we'd like to thank you for taking your time out of your day to come join us and talk about Georgian wines. It's really been an eye-opener for us, and we can't wait, actually, to go to Georgia and try the wines firsthand at the winery like you did. Really a pleasure, and we really enjoy your taking your time with us today. Folks, you've been listening to The Connected Table Live. This is David Ransom and my host, Melanie Young, and we will see you again next week. And until then, have a delicious week.